Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You're listening to Big Ideas on Radio National and Radio Australia. And today, in this series of programs about works of art that changed history, we're delving into the life, work and legacy of Charles Dickens. My name is Terry Lane, and in this program we'll be considering the whole output of Dickens and his impact on English society in the 19th century, but we'll also be paying special attention to Oliver Twist. Oliver Twist was his second novel, and it's the book that points the way to what was to come in Dickens' work. Charles John Huffman Dickens was born in 1812. He was the son of a reasonably prosperous but feckless father, who managed to fritter away his money on maintaining his social position to such an extent that Dickens' parents spent time in the Marshalsea debtors' prison, and Charles was sent to work in a boot polish factory, sticking labels on the jars. He was 12 at the time, and the dual ignominies of debtors' prison and working in what these days we would call a Dickensian factory, shaped his attitudes to class, working conditions, slum dwelling, snobbery and poverty that would inform his writing for the rest of his life. Karl Marx wrote that Dickens issued to the world more political and social truths than have been uttered by all the professional politicians, publicists and moralists put together. In 1827, at the age of 15, Dickens became a clerk in the law firm of Ellis and Blackmore. At 17, he became a court stenographer with a reputation for fast and accurate shorthand. In 1834, he became a political journalist, and his career as a writer began. In 1836, his first novel, Pickwick Papers, was published, and 1 year later, he began the serialisation of Oliver Twist. Oliver Twist so shocked middle-class readers that many couldn't accept that such conditions and people existed in the great city of London. American writer Jane Smiley, who you might remember joined us for the program on Harriet Beecher Stowe, is also a biographer of Charles Dickens. So it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Smiley back to Big Ideas for more insights into the life and work of another writer, also driven by an ambition to reform society through his words. Dr. Smiley says that we know a lot more about Charles Dickens' early life than his contemporaries did, from whom he kept the more sordid details of his experiences of poverty, debtors' prison, and working in the boot polish factory.
Well, Dickens was a person from the, let's say, the not very well-off English middle class. And there were some things in his family's background, his father's bankruptcy, and also an embezzlement by his mother's father, that he was embarrassed about. So when he first entered public life as a writer, which he did at a very young age, around 24, he was careful to keep all of these things quiet. I think it was evident to him that he didn't need anything, he didn't need any questions about his life to enter into his hoped for fame and public persona. And so he was quite secretive throughout his life. And what always happens with writers who are very secretive is that as soon as their backs are turned, people industriously find out all about them. And so in the time since Dickens died, which was in 1870, people have sifted through every conceivable letter and communication and memory to come up with a fuller picture of Dickens' life than maybe his contemporaries had. But I would say they were content with the picture that they had. You know,
it's odd, isn't it?
They didn't live in the same kind of all information all the time society that we do.
No, but as you say, he was probably the first true celebrity that the world had known. You would think that there would have been some sort of a hunger to know more about his origins.
Well, maybe there was, but he was very effective at stemming that curiosity. Late in his life, he did an interesting thing, an interesting thing happened to him, let's put it that way. He was in a train wreck on the way from France to London. A train went over the side of a bridge, and he was in, three of the cars fell off the tracks, and many people were killed and injured. And he was in a car that was left hanging. And he managed to escape and also to help get his companions out. And then he went back and got his manuscript, which was sitting in the pocket of his jacket. And then he went down to the bottom of the river. And using his hat, he carried water to people who were in very bad shape. And he helped lots of people. And when there was an inquiry into this sometime later, not even very long later, but a few weeks later, he insisted that his activities not be broadcast. He didn't want to appear at the hearing. He didn't want people to know what he did. And I think that was partly because his companion was Ellen Ternan. His other companion, I believe, was her mother, and he wanted to keep that a secret. But the other thing was, he was a truly benevolent person, and he knew that he would somehow gain some sort of exploitive recognition for the things that he had done, and he didn't want that. It was the whole crash was a horror to him.
Nevertheless, Jane, there is a paradox here, isn't there? When you consider how many of his characters he wrote with such sympathy about their formative experiences, mm-hmm. and so many of his characters, like, say, Lady Dedlock in Bleak House, had that deep feeling of shame for something that had happened in the past, and yes. other characters felt a deep sense of shame for things that had happened in the past just to people who were associated with them, mm-hmm. Like, for instance, Rose in Oliver Twist. Mm-hmm. Now, that Dickens himself should feel that his past was somehow a stigma that might affect his reputation does seem a bit peculiar.
But he did feel his past to be a stigma, and he felt it at the time. Let's say the biggest event in his childhood was when his family had to go to debtor's prison. And the family went to the prison and stayed there, as the family in Little Dorrit does. And Dickens was sent out to work. He was taken out of school and sent out to work, and he was put up at a boarding house with a kind of monstrous landlady. But all of the biographers make the case that the shame was not necessarily in the debt. When he worked in the blacking factory, he was quite good at doing the job he had to do, which was packaging, shoe blacking. And they put him in front of a window, and people would come and stare at this 12-year-old child doing his job. And I think for Dickens, there was a kind of ambiguous quality about that. On the one hand, he was fabulous at doing his job, and he was very quick, and so he drew more and more of an audience. But on the other hand, the very circumstances that led to his being there were humiliating. The great thing to remember about Dickens is that he was a person of intense pride, and he had this his whole life. He wanted to do well. He wanted to be seen as a respectable and valued member of society, and he didn't want to be laughed at, and yet he was always putting himself in a position of display. And I think he was quite ambivalent, both drawn to and repelled by the kind of display that that he was always in a position of. Other novelists of the period, Trollope and George Eliot too, had a similar sort of reaction. And I think it's part of the British, especially the Victorian British literary world. It's a small world, and it's a gossipy world, and it's a world where what you do is constantly discussed and possibly made fun of by your peers and other people who are associated with you. And so it can make you, and it made them very self-conscious. But added to that was Dickens' own sense of amour propre, I think is even more what you would call it than pride. It was a sense of always wanting to be respected and never wanting to be demeaned or disrespected. One thing that you might say is he was a short guy. He was short, and he was nice looking, and he was dynamic, and he dressed with a kind of flair that upper class people found a little outre. And so he was always courting looks, and yet in some sense rejecting the right of the person to look at him. So he's a paradox in that way, and that was one of the reasons I found him quite interesting.
You're listening to Big Ideas on Radio National and Radio Australia, and I'm talking to writer Jane Smiley, who has written a biography of Charles Dickens. And Jane, Dickens' genius as a novelist is undoubtedly his empathy with people of all classes, and I have a fairly old American edition of Oliver Twist. Now, we should point out Oliver Twist was his second novel, but Pickwick Papers probably doesn't quite qualify as a novel with a continuous narrative, but Oliver Twist then becomes his first serious novel. And in a preface to this American edition, and he must have written this many years after the original publication of the book, he defends his tale of the lives of what he calls the most criminal and degraded of London's population from his detractors, who apparently were saying that such characters have no place in polite literature. Raising the question, was he an original in this? Was he the first person? Because you certainly don't find this in Jane Austen or Charlotte Bronte.
No.
So was he original in making characters of the lower classes so central to his narrative?
Well, I don't think so exactly, because many of the great 18th century authors loved those rambunctious, rowdy, rough characters and were willing to portray them, you know, Fielding and Smollett and those people. But they didn't necessarily portray them with the kind of empathy that Dickens did. And they also weren't so interested as Dickens was in cause and effect. One of the things that was characteristic of Dickens in Oliver Twist and in all of his later works was he was interested in how people got to be who they were. And he looked at their childhoods. He looked at Oliver and he talked about Oliver's very modest and humble beginnings and Oliver's experiences. And then he says, okay, so what kind of boy comes out of this sort of experience? And Oliver is one example, but the boy criminals that surround Oliver are other examples of how a boy gets to be this way. I think before Dickens, it was generally felt, well, you are who you are. If you're a criminal, you're born to be a criminal. And if you're a good person, you're born to be a good person. But Dickens said, no, this isn't how it works. How it works is people begin in innocence, and their experiences, children, the way they're treated by people like Mr. Bumble the Beetle, influence how they develop, influence who they are, and what they become. And to us, this seems like not a revelation, but in fact, I think in Dickens' day, it was a thing that people hadn't thought of in quite that way. And that was one of the great things that Dickens did by portraying boys like Oliver Twist and boys like David Copperfield from their earliest years into their adulthood. He essentially said, okay, nature and nurture coexist in the child. And it isn't all nature. Some of it is nurture. And we can see the cause and effect of how nurture influences a person to become the way he is. And that was a revelation. I always remember that one of Freud's favorite books was David Copperfield, and I am not at all disinclined to think that this influenced Freud in his thinking about cause and effect in the lives of a person. And Dickens was really the first person who did that, who made those step-by-step developmental ideas part of a novel. And it was a great thing to do.
Well, your summary of Oliver Twist in 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel is Oliver Twist is a how-to manual for making criminals. First you deny them porridge and all sense of self-respect, then you give them criminal associates and teach them a few skills such as picking pockets and prostitution, and you have a criminal. Actually,
you can have a criminal. One of the things he points out in Oliver Twist is that you don't always have a criminal.
That's right.
You don't have one with Oliver and you don't have one with Nancy. That human kindness does a lot to mitigate, let's say, the narcissism and the insensitivity that is a mark of the criminal life. But it doesn't mean that you necessarily get anywhere. Oliver gets somewhere. Oliver is discovered by his grandfather and saved, but Nancy is beaten to death by Sykes, her pimp. I think he is her pimp. So it's risky business in the criminal world to be a decent person, but some people are brave enough to do that. And Dickens was aware of the complexity of this world. He didn't think it was at all simple, but he did feel that it was up to society, it was up to those who have more things and are more educated to attempt to change the circumstances of those who have nothing. And that if they did change those circumstances, more of those who have nothing would turn out to have humane instincts. And to me, that's liberalism. You know, that's why I think of Dickens as a liberal novelist, even though he didn't enunciate all the sentiments that we necessarily associate with liberalism. He saw human nature as malleable, and he saw human society as changeable. If you had good public sanitation, if you had good education, if you had good health care, and if people were honest and kind to one another, society would change, individuals would change, and life would become better for more people. I think that would be the gist of his point of view.
What did Karl Marx think of him?
You know, that's a question I cannot answer at this moment. I think Engels was fond of David Copperfield. Of course, Dickens was a hugely popular writer. He was far more popular than Karl Marx in his day.
Got better jokes.
Yes. And so because Marx and Engels were sort of his contemporaries, they were quite familiar with him. And I think that they respected his analysis, but of course they carried it further than he would have.
Well, one of the points that you make in the biography is contrasting Marx with Dickens, that Marx believed that you reform society by reforming its institutions, but Dickens believed you reform society by reforming the relationships within society.
Yes, I think Dickens truly believed that people are much more effective in changing one another on a personal basis than on an institutional or political basis. There would be no reason not to reform an institution, in his view. But you can't all... He had a distrust of institutions, and especially charitable institutions, because he found that often their charity was entirely self-interested and it wasn't accompanied by kindness. And for Dickens, all charity should be accompanied by kindness and even fun. That's one of the things that he shows in A Christmas Carol. People learn more from having fun, and they gain more in terms of a sense of relationship to society than they do from having a handout and having it be sort of handed out to them in a guilt-inducing way.
You're listening to Radio National, Big Ideas, and the big idea this week is the effect of Charles Dickens and his work on British society in the 19th century and indeed into the early part of the 20th century, and I'm talking with Jane Smiley, who is one of Dickens' biographers.
One thing I'd like to say, Dickens was an incredibly energetic man. And he also seems to have been quite an insomniac. And so one of the things he did for years and years, possibly most of his life, was he took long walks at night around London. He was quite brave. He would go into any neighborhood. He would talk to any person. And this showed up in his work. He had a wonderful ear for the vagaries of speech, and he was a great mimic. And this is probably his earliest and greatest talent, was to hear people talk and be able to reproduce it on the page and to understand and take pleasure in the variety of spoken English. And I think that this infused not only his work, and we always take great pleasure in the way that people talk and the variety of language he uses, but it also showed him things about life in London and to a certain extent in England as a whole, that other people who weren't as energetic and didn't have as much, you know, didn't put as many miles on their shoes as Dickens did, other people could avoid walking into the worst neighborhoods, or would avoid walking into the worst neighborhoods, or would be driven around in carriages or something, or taxis or something. But Dickens walked there. And so he saw things that his fellow writers and many of his fellow, let's say, upper middle class people never saw. And that spurred him to wanting to change those things. So we have to think of him not only as an artistic phenomenon, but also maybe a sort of superhuman, a man of superhuman energy, who had to put his energy to good use, which he did. And he never hesitated to act on what he saw.
There's one thing about Oliver Twist that we can't escape commenting on, and that's in the character of Fagin. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when David Lean's film was released, and it was made in 1948, in which Alec Guinness made his memorable portrayal of Fagin, it was for a time banned in the United States as a result of pressure from Jewish groups who objected to the anti-Semitism in the film. Mm-hmm. But the anti-Semitism in the book is like a constant slap in the face.
It is, and Dickens was, that's what I said earlier, that he wasn't a liberal in the modern sense of the word. He had I would say, an automatic anti-Semitism. It's not the same in every book, but it is the case in Oliver Twist. I liken it to The Merchant of Venice. It's something that was routine in its day.
Can I just say, I thought about that comparison, but the character of Shylock can be changed just by different inflections on the part of the actor. But it seems to me there is nothing that you can do to rescue the character of Fagin from the implication of Dickens' writing, that while most people are not determined by birth, Jews are.
Well, I'm not going to defend him. He had his prejudices, and a lot of his prejudices were racist. Would I, in his shoes, have made Fagin Jewish? No. You know, I would probably have made him something that will be totally opprobrious to people 150 years from now. But, you know, I do think you have to read things with some forgiveness of the writer and some understanding that every writer is a limited, and especially every novelist, is a limited and specific person.
We're including this program about Dickens in a series of programs that includes one about Harriet Beecher Stowe. Mm-hmm. And we could be confident, you know, when I talked to you about Mrs. Stowe, we were confident that she wrote with reformist intentions. She wasn't just simply writing for entertainment. Now,
yes, I think we can be confident about that with Dickens, too.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the things that he did in the late 1830s was that he got connected with a very wealthy woman named Angela Burdett Coutts, who was the heir to a huge banking fortune. She is the second wealthiest woman in English society after Queen Victoria. She had charitable impulses, and she would send Dickens out to look into things, and then she would come up with the money to fix them in whatever way that they could. One of the things they did was start a little institution for helping prostitutes turn their lives around. And when you look at Victorian society, you have to say, wow, it's amazing to me that they thought that they were going to actually do something, even with all the money she had, to clean up this mess that was Victorian London. I mean, literally, Victorian London was a mess. Even the churchyards were so full of rotting corpses that the grave diggers complained about stumbling around in the muck of rotting corpses. I mean, that's to me the image of Victorian London. And it clearly took a government, it clearly took a national will to clean it up. But Dickens and Mrs. Coutts, you know, they took their shovel and they did their best. And Dickens' writing was effective in showing all the things that, or many, not all, but many of the things that needed to be done, and also in inspiring people to go out and change things. There are a lot of examples of this, of course, and Oliver Twist isn't the only one, but there are other examples where he attempted to do something about things. And he both did it as a citizen and did it as a writer.
That was Dr. Jane Smiley, whose biography of Charles Dickens is published in the Weidenfeld and Nicholson Lives series. You're listening to Radio National and Radio Australia, and this program of Big Ideas is one in a series about works of art that changed history. Now, one character that appears in all Dickens' books is the City of London. His descriptions of the slums are vivid and eye-watering, and when in Oliver Twist the vengeful mob corner Bill Sykes, he's trapped in a squalid part of the city known as Jacob's Island, of which Dickens writes, "They must have powerful motives for a secret residence, or be reduced to a destitute condition indeed, who seek a refuge in Jacob's Island."
Near to that part of the Thames on which the church at Rotherhithe abuts, where the buildings of the banks are dirtiest and the vessels of the river blackest with the dust of colliers and the smoke of close-built, low-roofed houses, there exists the filthiest, the strangest, the most extraordinary of the many localities that are hidden in London, wholly unknown even by name to the great mass of its inhabitants. To reach this place, the visitor has to penetrate through a maze of close, narrow and muddy streets, thronged by the roughest and poorest of waterside people, and devoted to the traffic they may be supposed to occasion. The cheapest and least delicate provisions are heaped in the shops. The coarsest and commonest articles of wearing apparel dangle at the salesman's door and from the house parapet and windows. Jostling with unemployed labourers of the lowest class, ballast heavers, coal whippers, brazen women, ragged children, and the riffraff and refuse of the river, he makes his way with difficulty along, assailed by offensive sights and smells from the narrow alleys which branch off on the right and left, and deafened by the clash of ponderous wagons that bear great piles of merchandise from the stacks of warehouses that rise from every corner. Arriving at length in streets remoter and less frequented than those through which he has passed, he walks beneath tottering house fronts, projecting over the pavement, dismantled walls that seem to totter as he passes, chimneys half crushed, half hesitating to fall, windows guarded by rusty iron bars that time and dirt have almost eaten away, every imaginable sign of desolation and neglect. In such a neighbourhood, beyond Dockhead in the borough of Southwark, stands Jacob's Island, surrounded by a muddy ditch 6 or 8 feet deep and 15 or 20 wide when the tide is in, once called Mill Pond, but known in the days of this story as Folly Ditch. It is a creek or inlet from the Thames, and can always be filled at high water by opening the sluices at the lead mills from which it took its old name. At such times, a stranger, looking from one of the wooden bridges thrown across it at Mill Lane, will see the inhabitants of the houses on either side lowering from their back doors and windows buckets, pails, domestic utensils of all kinds, in which to haul the water up. And when his eye is turned from these operations to the houses themselves, his utmost astonishment will be excited by the scene before him. Crazy wooden galleries, common to the backs of half a dozen houses, with holes from which to look upon the slime beneath. Windows broken and patched, with poles thrust out on which to dry the linen that is never there. Rooms so small, so filthy, so confined, that the air would seem too tainted even for the dirt and squalor which they shelter. Wooden chambers thrusting themselves out above the mud and threatening to fall into it, as some have done. Dirt-besmirched walls and decaying foundations. Every repulsive lineament of poverty, every loathsome indication of filth, rot and garbage. All these ornament the banks of Folly Ditch.
Now, it so happens that the description of Jacob's Island is not a product of Charles Dickens' imagination. The place really did exist, presumably exactly as he described it. You're listening to Big Ideas on Radio National and Radio Australia, and a man who knows Dickens as well as any is Professor David Parossian. Professor Parossian is the editor of A Companion to Charles Dickens, a work that puts Dickens' writings into their historical and social context. It's a massive book. It'll be available in Australia next year, and you should start saving because it's going to cost $262. David Parossian is also the editor of the Dickens Quarterly, which is published from the Department of English at the University of Massachusetts. So he's the man who should know if there is any truth in the story that the description of Jacob's Island so shocked Dickens' contemporaries that a program of slum clearance was begun.
Yes, there's a good deal of truth in that. Towards the end of the novel, the gang in dissolution retreat to a safe house. And Dickens describes this, the location of the safe house, very precisely as Jacob's Island, which was a low-lying parish on the south bank of the Thames, the home of people known as the longshoremen, people who worked on the river. And it was a truly notorious place, drinking water, sewage, the river, a ditch full of dead bodies or animals. They were all mixed up, and the drinking water was drawn from such sources. Well, locating the gang's retreat there, he describes it in a great deal of detail. The description first appeared in 1839, and to give you some sense of the contribution that this description made, the horror it created, if one looks at reports which were commissioned by Parliament investigating the outbreak of cholera in 1849, and if you read those descriptions and you compare them with the descriptions in the novel, they're remarkably close. And in 1850, Dickens was giving a speech to the members of the Metropolitan Sanitary Association, and in that speech he notes, indeed, yes, there were some improvements.
Well, there are a couple of other reforms that Dickens brought about in a relatively short time, and one was the closure of the Marshalsea debtors' prison where his parents were imprisoned.
Yes, in 1824 his father was arrested for the non-payment of a relatively small amount of money. I believe it was a bill he owed to a baker or to a butcher. And the insane system which prevailed at that time was that if you were unable to pay, you would then be removed. You would be put into a debtor's prison, a debtor's jail. And so John Dickens was carted off. Along with him went his wife and the young children. And most painfully of all, as far as Charles was concerned, was that he was left alone. He was put into temporary lodgings, quite some distance from his parents, who were more comfortably accommodated in jail than they had been recently in their own living conditions. Well, John Dickens only spent, he was arrested in February, and by April and May, he was out. Dickens actually didn't write about this in an extensive way until Little Dorrit, which the first half of that book takes place in the Marshalsea jail. But by then, actually, the Marshalsea had been closed. So he created publicity, but it did come later. And so one has to be cautious about saying he was directly responsible for its exposure, but he certainly was responsible for bringing attention to a continuing system of dealing with debtors.
Well, let's talk about Oliver Twist. What is the connection between Oliver Twist and the Poor Laws and the institutions which we now think of characteristically as Dickensian, the institution of the workhouse, for the parish workhouse? What were the Poor Laws?
Well, the Poor Laws really engage an enormous sweep of English social history. Poverty, the poor, indigent people, sick people, aged people, had received, well, let us say, minimalist support through the church and through the monasteries. Henry VIII, with his program of the dissolution of monasteries, did away with the system of almsgiving. And so it left, it took away one of the means of support. And so the question then becomes, well, what do we do about this? Parliament meets, a commission is set up, which works for over a couple of years, and they send out people inquiring all over the country, and they want to gather facts, they want to get statistics. And they come up with a very impressive document, which is put to Parliament and eventually is passed as the Poor Law Amendment Act. Well, what the Act did, it tried to abolish or do away with the idea of parish support. There were some 15,000 parishes in England. Instead, the proposal was that we have combine them into 600 unions. We try and establish some uniform conditions under which people are admitted and qualified for help. We will provide some proper buildings. We will appoint government architects to design workhouses. And to treat people fairly, we will have government dietaries. We will have tables that show how many ounces of bread and soup and so forth should be meted out on a weekly basis. Now, underlying all of this was the notion, well, people should be less eligible. That is to say, and Mr. Bumble explains this in the novel in a rather cynical way, he said the proper management of the poor laws or of the system is to give the paupers exactly what they don't want, and then they will get tired of coming.
They won't ask for more, yes.
Exactly, exactly.
Dickens rises to some heights of, it goes beyond irony into sarcasm when he is describing the administrative committee for Oliver's poorhouse. Now, I get the impression from that the administrative committee was some committee of gentlemen probably appointed by the parish in some way, but that they were, in at least in his descriptions, uniformly hypocritical and mean-spirited. Was that an accurate description?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure there were exceptions, but the guardians, as they were known, they were elected by people who were eligible to vote, and rather in the way that councillors and people in a holding office act today, they felt they had to represent the interests of the people who were paying the rates, that is to say the taxes, which provided the support for administering and helping the poor. But they wanted to spend the money wisely and carefully. But they also seemed to be, certainly in Dickens' view, motivated by a principle not of generosity, but rather of meanness. Dickens attacks them very fiercely, and he touched on a nerve that reverberated throughout the entire country. What's really important about this piece of social legislation in 1834 is that it represents a real milestone in English social history. It was an attempt by the government, because after all of the provisions were to be supervised from Westminster, from Parliament, or by Parliament. It was an attempt by the government to say, look, poverty is a national problem. It's not something local. It's not something we can just rely on the goodwill of neighbours. We've got to address this as a nation. St. John points out in his gospel, the poor always ye have with you. And I think that was a given. What the Poor Law Amendment Act attempts to do is to confront that on a national scale. Now, clearly, there were many failures, but it's the beginning of, certainly in England, of social legislation that continues to evolve. And we haven't solved the problem of poverty.
You're listening to Big Ideas on Radio National and Radio Australia. Today we're talking about the life, the times and the works of Charles Dickens. And I am speaking at the moment with Professor David Parossian, who is the editor of a companion to Charles Dickens, a massive work that puts Dickens' writings in their historical and social context and will be available in Australia early next year. David, talking about the necessary reforms, what did Dickens envisage as the way of reforming society? As I understand it, he was not by any means a revolutionary, and that his idea of a reformed society in a way seems to be encapsulated in A Christmas Carol, in that Scrooge at the end of the story is still the owner of Scrooge and Marley, and Bob Cratchit is still his clerk, but the relationship between the two has changed.
First of all, I think most importantly, Dickens didn't have a kind of intellectual blueprint. This is simply how society has got to be. This is how we go about through social legislation in bringing about justice in the world. He certainly thought social legislation was going to be was of paramount importance, to wit, the business of improving sanitation and housing conditions. You've got to have laws that make sure that people get clean water, that their living conditions are decent, and so forth. But at the same time, Dickens, and this is really the message that is, I think, the most important in A Christmas Carol, he firmly believed that change comes through the heart. Christmas Carol opens with coldness and darkness and mean spirits, and Scrooge simply doesn't want to know anything about the poor. Haven't I given enough already, he complains. Go away, leave me alone. And in the course of this wonderfully fanciful story in which he reviews his life, he comes to realize the importance of generosity, of celebration, of warmth, of kindness. And in looking over his own life, he is brought to a new awareness of the importance of generosity and kindness in social relationships, of behaving decently. I mean, he doesn't think that he can solve the problem, obviously, for all of the poor people in London, but he can make life and working conditions somewhat better, somewhat improved for his own clerk, Tim Cratchit, and by extension his family. And it's not just a one-off thing. I mean, it's a change of attitude that permeates his behavior and continues through the rest of his imagined fictional life.
What about his theories of crime and punishment? The edition of Oliver Twist that I have has a preface which I think might have been written later than the first edition, in which Dickens is obviously arguing against some of his earlier critics. And one of the things that he says in this preface is that even with capital punishment, it is no deterrent. Bill Sykes would have murdered Nancy regardless of whether there was capital punishment or not. Now, it sounds as though he is opposed to capital punishment, but he might just be commenting on what he thinks is its inefficiency.
At that point in his career, and we're talking about late 1830s, he was absolutely and unequivocally opposed to capital punishment. He wrote five brilliant letters addressed to the editor of the Daily News. It was a newspaper which Dickens himself founded and edited very briefly. And in those five letters, he argues brilliantly, vehemently, polemically against capital punishment. He opposes it on principle. He thinks the spectacle, and we have to remember, when we're talking about capital punishment up until 1868 in England, capital punishment takes place outside the jail. It's public. It's a public spectacle, and he thinks it's an obscene and a degrading one. It's an invitation to further crime. Criminals, non-criminals, but they attend, and it's an opportunity to pick pockets for prostitutes to solicit business, for all kinds of terrible things to go on. he thinks it even works in a way perversely to reinforce homicidal tendencies, because after all, for a certain kind of criminal, it's the great show. It's the one opportunity he can claim central stage. His words are taken down. He's sketched. His words are sold and disseminated in the press. If not an incentive, it can be rationalized. Well, I took a life. I will pay for it with mine. Now, that's in 1846. 3 years later, he recognizes that on this issue, he's ahead of public opinion. And so he modifies his stance and says, well, okay, what we need to do is to move executions, judicial murder, you might call it, we need to move that inside the prison wall, put it out of sight. And then in by 1864, 1868, he's coming yet to another opinion, and he thinks that there are people like Sykes who are ultimately bad, and although he's loath to continue to support capital punishment, he thinks it's the only thing that society, the only alternative is simply to get rid of such types. Ironically, by 1868, the objective of putting it, removing it inside the jails had been achieved, but capital punishment, as I'm sure you know, it continued in England until the Labour government, 1965, finally abolished it.
We're running out of time, and I do want to get you to comment on one other theme that recurs in Dickens' books, and is in Oliver Twist, and that is the theme of the fallen woman and the illegitimate child. Both Oliver and Rose are illegitimates, and Harry, who is desperately in love with Rose, has to give up his business ambitions and become a clergyman in order to protect Rose from the haughty disparagement of the London rich. Now, and as we know, there are other characters who are illegitimate in other novels. It's as though this was one of his obsessions.
Yes, I would agree. At least, if not an obsession, an abiding or a continuing theme. And at the heart of it, I think, lies something that's really basic to Dickens' fiction, and that is he believes that children are born not as some of his evangelical contemporaries liked to proclaim, burdened with sin, that we're born into a fallen world, but rather that we are born innocent and we shouldn't inherit the crimes or the misdemeanors or whatever it is of the fathers. In the case of illegitimacy, in Dickens' view, this was a wholly unwarranted and absurd social stigma. It was the application of an attitude that was informed by religious prejudice. A child born out of wedlock is burdened with sin. That's true, of course, of Oliver, of Rose, two wonderful and totally innocent and adorable children in fictional terms in Oliver Twist. The most sustained and, I think, very perceptive portrait of this is the central character in Bleak House, and that's young Esther Summerson. And Esther is illegitimately born, and she is raised by her aunt. And her aunt is always reminding her, Esther, you are your mother's disgrace. It's better, Esther, if you had never been born. Now, imagine saying that to a child on her birthday. And, of course, it damages her psychologically. It damages her deeply. Now, Dickens identified with that, not because he himself, he was perfectly legitimately born, but the experience he had of being thrown into the world of darkness, of dirt. He knew what it was like to be aware of one's ability and one's talent, and at the same time to be put into a social position whereby you were treated with almost complete contempt and disgrace. And so illegitimacy was just one of those badges. He describes Oliver at his birth as this little child wrapped up in rough calico rags. He could have been wrapped up in a blanket and luxury, and his whole life would have been different. But what's unchanging is the child that's inside there. And so any social system that builds in these forms of social discrimination, Dickens found abhorrent. And he continues to attack that and to broaden that attack, moving the next, I think, hero who is important in these terms is Pip. Now, Pip is not illegitimate, but he is brought up in such a way, I mean, he's an orphan, he's brought up in such a way as to feel apologetic, and his intense humiliation occurs when he goes to Satis House and he meets Miss Havisham and Estella, the young, beautiful woman he falls in love with. And he learns to think of himself as inferior because, as Estella says, your hands are rough, your boots are thick, and you call knaves jacks. Well, there the whole thing is laid out. How you look, the way you dress, and how you speak, that defines you in a social system where these sorts of absurd social values predominate.
David, we'll have to finish, and I have to finish with the big question. Was England a better place because Charles Dickens had lived and written?
I, without hesitation, I would say yes. And partly because of the contribution, the sustained contribution he makes to improvements in all kinds of ways in English social life. But the other great and absolutely abiding legacy. We wouldn't be having this this talk now if it weren't for the fact that he was such a brilliant, commanding, and interesting, inventive, imaginative writer. Dickens has brought and will continue to bring more joy and pleasure into everybody's lives, or everybody who takes the time to read him, to respond to his brilliance, his cleverness, his humor, and to the sheer pleasure that I and countless other people all feel in engaging his prose. And so in that respect, without any hesitation whatsoever, yes, we're all ever so much better off for the life of Charles Dickens.
That was Professor David Parossian, editor of A Companion to Charles Dickens and also the general editor of the Dickens Quarterly. The Companion is published by Blackwell and it's scheduled to go on sale in Australia next February. Well, Dickens has left an extraordinary legacy. None of his books has ever been out of print. More than 180 movie and television adaptations of his works have been produced. David Lean's 1948 film of Oliver Twist with Alec Guinness as Fagin was banned in America because it was anti-Semitic. It was also banned at the same time in Egypt for not being anti-Semitic enough. Lionel Bart's musical of Oliver was Bart's one big hit, and the film directed by Carol Reed won the Best Picture Oscar of 1968. Charles Dickens died in 1870, aged 58. He's buried in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey, and the inscription on his tomb reads, "He was a sympathiser to the poor, the suffering, and the oppressed, and by his death, one of England's greatest writers is lost to the world." Next week in Big Ideas, Art That Changed the World, we will be talking about Alan Paton and his novel Cry the Beloved Country. Cry the Beloved Country was written before apartheid became official law in South Africa, but it alerted the world to the horrors of the regime of white supremacy that was to come. I hope you can join me for Cry the Beloved Country and Alan Paton in Big Ideas at the same time on Radio National and Radio Australia next week. My name is Terry Lane, and this program was produced by James Paniki with the assistance of Peter Brown.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.